This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with James Mathewson. How are you, James?
I'm really well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. You are the, is it the head wine buyer at Waitrose or the in charge of the team of wine buyers?
I suppose maybe both. So my title is trading manager, and so I look all of the, after all of the buyers who buy wine at Waitrose.
What about beers as well and spirits? Or
so we split the teams. So Pier Paolo Petrassi is head of all of drinks at Waitrose, and he looks after beers, cider, spirits, soft drinks, and that's one half of the team. And I used to look after that team, and then the other half of the team is wines, and I now look after that. So we look after all of drinks at Waitrose, and I look after the wine side.
Okay, but your background's accountancy.
Not a proper accountant.
As a
commercial manager, I'll get in trouble with all of our accountants at work. So I was a commercial manager for Pier Paolo. So it's kind of like a bridge between the commercial margin and the operating margin that we make in our business, and just supporting the buyers with negotiations and how we can get efficiency and cost savings in our supply chain. So that's how I got to know him originally.
Okay. So what I want to talk about today is a little bit about the structure of the wine side and within Waitrose. As Waitrose is a, would be, I would call it a premium supermarket, you know. Is there anyone who'd be sitting above you guys in terms of premiumness in the supermarket category?
I mean, you've got Marks and Spencer's, who we a competitor and run a similar type of thing. But obviously, they've got a real focus on food to go, food for later. Mm. And then you've got, you know, super premium Fortnum & Mason's, Harrods, and that kind of stuff. But there aren't that many people, I don't think, who do their weekly grocery shop at Harrods. I wish I was one of them, but yeah.
One thing we forgot to mention last week is you guys have a royal warrant, don't you?
We do.
And who's that from?
So at the moment we've got two, and they're obviously currently going through a process of changing because we've obviously got a new monarch. So at the moment we have them from Queen Elizabeth, and that's obviously changing. And we've also got it from Prince Charles, and that's obviously changing as well. Mm. So we go through that process. So at the moment we have those warrants, and that means we supply goods and services to the households.
In theory, just because you had a royal warrant with the Queen doesn't mean that you'll necessarily get an automatic royal warrant, but being tied in already with Charles probably gives you a bit of an inside running.
Hopefully.
When do they review it all?
I think it started happening already, as far as I'm aware. I'm not very close to the process, to be honest, but I think just as a matter of course, they have to change the warrants themselves because we don't have the late Queen anymore, and obviously Prince Charles is no longer Prince Charles. So I think by definition, they have to do a lot of admin in terms of changing it. And I think they do periodic reviews of holders to see whether you're actually still, you know, working with the household and providing them with things.
Let's move on to the thing we really want to talk about, which is the wines. How is the team structured within Waitrose?
Sure. So you've got, if I start at the top, so you've got Pier Paolo Petrassi looks after all of drinks, and then I look after wines, and then I have a team of buyers who buy wines. And the way we separate out the areas and chop up the areas is geographically. So we have a buyer for half of France. We have another buyer for the other half of France, but also rosé included in that, because a lot of our rosé comes from southern France, so we link those two areas together. We've got a buyer for Iberia and the Americas, a buyer for Italy and South Africa, a buyer for sparkling, so champagne and sparkling, a buyer for England and formats, Eastern Europe, Austria, Germany, rest of world. We've got some Greek, Lebanese, and then Australia and New Zealand, and fortified and sweet too. And then we also have waitroseseller.com, which has an additional exclusive range which goes on it. So we have a buyer looking after that as well. So that's how we chop up the areas, basically. And then those buyers look after that geographical area.
Yeah, they're not necessarily naturally, you don't think Italy and South Africa, you don't tie them together particularly.
The good thing about it is that it's Northern and Southern Hemisphere. So instead of having everything land on your plate post vintage in one go, you get a slight opportunity to manage Southern Hemisphere on that timeline versus vintage, and then Northern Hemisphere. It doesn't always work perfectly because they're not quite perfectly 6 months apart, but that's why. And then we also have to look at the complexity of the areas, the number of SKUs, the relative turnover, because you've got you know, lines like Prosecco and sparkling are just huge, huge turnover, not necessarily a huge range of SKUs, but huge turnover. Things like Pinot Grigio, you know, really, really big lines. And then in fortified and sweet, you've got all of these disparate stuff because you've got sweet wine from literally all over the world, from just about every country. So hugely diverse, but not doing anything like the volumes of Prosecco. So it's a balancing act of just trying to make sure we've got the right workload with each buyer.
I think one of the roles anybody who wants to join the wine trade is, I want to be a buyer. I mean, there's so many roles for sellers and not many roles for buyers, to be honest, in the business. And people always go, oh, you know, you want to be a buyer because if you're a seller, you're constantly trying to meet someone else's expectation. Whereas if you're a buyer, people are constantly trying to meet expectations, which is quite nice. You know, it's better to be the person pampered than the person having to do the pampering. What sort of skill sets are you looking for in your buyers?
Just going back to the pampering, I mean, we have to sell to customers. So we think of ourselves as sellers, actually, and having to do a really good job for our customers. And they're pretty tough on us. So it's not as privileged as it might look from the outside. I think Waitrose, I think is unique in the industry in that the buyers for Waitrose manage the entire area. So they look after blending, they look after management, label design, and that's their area. So quite often it's separated out into the industry between, say, a technical development side and then a purchasing side, but we don't do that. So in Waitrose, you are expected and we demand that you are able to do all of that. So we demand a relatively high level of qualification, so a minimum of a diploma. We've got four masters of wine in the team, and we also expect you to be a really pretty strong commercial animal. And they're quite rare. There's lots of great people who can do the commercials and do the numbers, and there's lots of great palates out there, but sometimes getting them both together is quite tricky. So they're a relatively rare beast, I would say.
Do you actually have trouble finding people? I mean, I imagine you put a job application, wine buyer, Waitrose, you must get flooded with people.
We do. You're right, we do. And I think, as you were saying earlier, it sounds really glamorous. I think wine buyer, the first thing that everyone always says to me is, oh my God, you've got the best job in the world. Now, I happen to think that I do. And I'm very, very lucky to be able to say that. It really is my dream job. And very few people get to say that. But I think it's not as glamorous as it sounds. And buy trips and blending, you know, in situ are difficult, tiring, exhausting events. It's not going out and drinking wine in a nice restaurant, as much as I would love it to be. I would say, though, that if you really love travelling and you love meeting people, and you're intrigued with the effectively infinite world of wine, because every vintage, every grape, every production, I mean, if you just think about the amount of combinations of viticulture and viniculture and what that ends up in the glass, it's pretty much infinite, and we're still planting. So I think if that piques your interest and you've got an inquisitive mind, I think that's probably the thing that we're looking for most. So a real passion for wine. And I think in my experience, you probably experienced this too, in my experience, beers, wines and spirits industry is generally very warm. I think everyone wants the best for everyone else. There's no real... I don't hear in this industry, I want to beat the competition or my wine's better than that person's wine. I think everyone does what they do and they're really proud of what they do, and they know that it's a competitive environment out there. And I think that's unique. When I think about, you know, grocery supermarket and big FMCG companies, I think that is different to the wines world. So I think we're looking for inquisitive minds who've got a real passion for wine. So yeah, we do get inundated. And I think if you speak to any wine buyer, I'm pretty sure most of them will say it's not as glamorous as it sounds. And like any job, the 99% of it is graft. A lot of it's spreadsheets, a lot of it's commercial. Yeah. I suppose what I would say is the 1% of the job, which is great, I think is really fabulous.
Okay. And in terms of the commercial skills that you're looking for, because obviously they're doing the negotiations now, aren't they?
Correct.
Is there a team that do negotiations, or is it you just go off and you're in Sicily and you're having a chat to some dude?
Yeah, so that's it. So it's up to the buyer to negotiate the price, and it's up to the buyer to negotiate shipment, travel, how it arrives into the UK, what it looks like, label, the cost of the label, cost of bottling, etc., whether we bottle it in situ, whether we ship it to the UK. So the buyer is completely responsible for all of that. So they have their own mini business, if you like. So they're responsible for all of the costs and obviously all of the retails for that.
a lot of the wines won't require any blending and bottling. They are a standard product that you've just purchased off the shelf, if you like. And then you've got your own label products as well. And is that where most of that comes from, that work in terms of blending and labeling and managing that?
Yeah, it's a mix, but definitely, yeah. So all of the own label, we're expected to, you know, blend that. That is our wine. So that will be our blend specifically. And that has our name on it, where it says Waitrose on the label. That's our wine and we're responsible for that. And we'll obviously work with the maker to produce the wine with the vintage to try and create a specific style. We then have other brands where they're not actually owned by us. It's not Waitrose's own label, but we work really closely with the producer, either because we're the exclusive partner, so we're the only people that buy that wine, in which case they will work with us, or because it's a wine which is important to the winery, albeit not exclusive, or simply because of the relationship we've got. So we have a relationship which go back 20, 30, 40, 50 years, where we've been buying the wine and we have such a close relationship with the maker, the producer, that they want to work with us on it. And then you're right, we stock off the peg things where we're not involved in the making or production. So there's lots and lots of brands that you can find. As much as I'd like love to tell Chef de Cave at Dom Perignon it needs a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that reserve wine, I think probably he's probably all right on his own.
So tell us about the ranges within Waitrose. How many ranges of own label have you got?
In terms of number of SKUs?
No. And by the way, SKU is a stock keeping unit for people. It's like if it's a wine from a particular size bottle, it's got its own SKU and all that sort of stuff. But no, I meant in terms of
brands. Sure. So we have an entry level wine brand, if you like, which is where we price the wines at $4.99, and they all have a look. We haven't got a specific name for that brand actually. And then we've got a brand called Blueprint, and that is kind of classic wines from around the world. So what we wanted that to be was a bit like WSET Level 3. If you wanted to go out and say, what does a Côte de Rhône taste like? What should it taste like? That's like a benchmark drink. That's the Blueprint. That's what you would expect to find, and that should taste like a classic example, if you like. And then we have got a brand called Number One, which actually you see all over the shop. So that's our top tier. So that's the best. That's the best that you can get. We find that quite tricky in wines, because the very best wine in the world is really quite subjective. And when you've got bottles of wine going for £100,000, and we've got, you know, a Number One Chianti, and we say this is the best you can get, but it's £15, obviously there's a disconnect there. So what I would say is that's the top tier that you can get in a UK supermarket. And we'll work with individual producers to produce that in partnership with them. That's our structure, if you like. And then we've got a brand called Loved and Found, which we launched in 2019. And that's 10 products. And we replace half of the wine. So we replace 5 wines every 12 months. But on an alternative 6-month rolling rotation. So there's 10 wines out there, and then we change 5 of them every half a year. And that came from us. I think really it was actually going out and being in situ with winemakers wherever we were in the world and trying really fabulous wines. And quite often we'd say, yeah, but it wouldn't sell, because people don't know the grape variety. So they're a bit scared by it. So the brief is to find kind of niche, esoteric wines, but they also have to be accessible, and they have to try and hit a price point of certainly below £10, below £9, below £8, where it's niche and esoteric, but it's also accessible, because it's really easy to go out and find a niche esoteric wine. I mean, there's tons and tons of them, but there might only be 2 cases available and it might cost £300. So that doesn't really hit the brief. So I think it's just trying to offer something. Our customers always tell us that I want to try something new and I want to buy the same thing every week. I want both. So the idea is that we could provide them with something new that didn't break the bank and they could try it. And if you don't like it, it's kind of nothing gained.
What's that brand called again?
Loved and Found.
Loved and Found. It's not Lost and Found. Loved and Found. And that's the one that you guys announced last week that you're removing the cap from.
Yeah.
Why are you doing that?
Well,
so the sleeve, the thing that goes over the top of the
cork. So it's got a sleeve or a capsule that goes over the top. So the reason we're doing that is because essentially it's unnecessary. I think if you're keeping a wine for ages in a damp cellar, then you might want a little bit more protection. But these wines are young, fresh wines that are designed to be drunk pretty much as soon as you've bought them. So there's not the need to protect the cork in the same way. Cork development has come on a long way in the last 10 years, but certainly the last 50. So again, you've got a much more robust seal there anyway. And we just view it as essentially unnecessary packaging. So it's a trial. We'll see how it goes. The range of feedback is really interesting. So, I mean, there are loads of wines out there already which don't have a capsule. And you go into any wine shop at any independent wine shop and you'll find a load of stuff without a capsule, loads of sparklers without a capsule. And, you know, others have done it in the market before. There's brands which don't do it. So I wouldn't say it's new, and we're the first supermarket to do it with own label brand. And we'll see how customers go for it. You know, it's interesting speaking to people having done it. Some say, yeah, don't know why you didn't do it ages ago. It's completely unnecessary. And I can get into my wine quicker. So it's great. And some people say, oh, it takes all the romance out of wine. So I think it's a complete spectrum of people liking it, not liking it, wanting it, not wanting it. But I think for those wines, modern day, what we can do with corks now, I think it's unnecessary.
But does that mean that all of your loved and found wines are cork? Because screw caps naturally don't tend to have it. They stand out on the shelf with that lovely cap. I do like the cap, don't get me wrong. I was a little bit disappointed in how much plastic you save from it, but the screw caps normally have that same sort of appearance, but there it's part of the tamper evident sort of side of the bottle.
So at the moment we've got a mix. So at the moment we've got a mix of cork and a mix of screw cap. And again, that's one of the challenging things about the Loved and Found range, is you will find something that's fantastic and unique, but it will have to, by definition, it will have to fit in with the current production of that site. So if that producer is producing everything under screw cap, then it's really tricky for us to say, on a relatively small production run, we want you to now stop doing cork. And it's the same for volumes that we bring over and then pack here in the UK. In the vast majority at the moment, that's screw cap.
Okay. And when you decided to remove the foil, just as an example of how the internal team works, where did that come from and how was that passed down to the members of the team?
Where did it come from? I mean, I suppose we're all out in the industry all the time. We're all buying wines all the time. And we've seen capsuleless wines, right? Mm. So I think it was just an organic discussion amongst all of us to say, if this is out there, you know, what should we be doing about it? One of the challenges that we've thought about was brand identity. So our blueprint wines, you know, that's quite a big part of the recognition on shelf, is being able to see that. Another one was, what was customers' perception? So there was a reticence because, you know, initial samples, we showed some people and they're like, oh, it's unfinished. So there's a little bit of reluctance there, and there's a bit of anxiety for consumers. And, you know, how has my wine been tampered with? Yep. Now, actually, when you think about it, well, if the cork's still in there, and flush, it's pretty much the same as any other wine, and certainly even a screw cap, because that could come off and go back on again and wouldn't look any different. So we then decided, where could we execute it? And Loved and Found seemed like, because we're churning that range quite fast, that seemed like the right place.
So if it doesn't take, it only takes you 6 months to change it back over?
Yeah, six months a year. And also because we're churning that range, it's quite easy to go out there and say, right, what's the impact? And then decide whether we want to make a wholesale change across other brands. It'd be interesting to see if brands in the marketplace, who we don't have huge influence over, it'll be interesting to see if it's something that we start seeing. Cork is more environmentally friendly as well
than
screw caps, arguably.
I disagree with that. I mean, you've got the number of times you hear Amarim say something like that, Amarim, the big cork producer, but then they never mention the failure rate and the carbon offset that the one bottle of corked wine makes a huge carbon dent in the budget. And to say that, you know, if you did it on carbon, it's clearly not true. But if you care about the Liberian links, then maybe.
Yeah, I suppose you've got to create the capsule from something, whereas the cork forests are, you know, sustainable. Mm. And failure rates on cork, I mean, TCA failure rates now on modern corks are very low.
What are they? Do you know? Do you have numbers?
We do have numbers, yeah, because I don't know it. I can get them to you, but off the top of my head. But we do have them as part of this project. We were looking at the failure rates.
And is the failure rate based on people returning the wine that's failed, or failure rate on you guys doing technical analysis?
Yeah, scientific testing.
Okay, yeah, I'd love to know what that failure rate is.
Yeah, we've got it. Yeah. So Barry Dick joined us last year, Barry Dick MW, with specifically looking at sustainability. And so he's pretty knowledgeable on the stuff.
If you can get those numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because no one, I mean, the IWC used to publish some numbers, and then it all became a bit difficult for them. And that's different, because that's on your perception threshold levels, and different people have different threshold levels and all that sort of thing.
No, this is testing. This is testing at site. And there's quite a few suppliers who are doing the same thing. So if you go to Symington's, they're doing the same thing and doing a lot of testing. So I think there's now more collaboration and corroboration of results around different suppliers as well, mm-hmm. using specific corks.
Okay, but what is it? Is it less than 1% now, or
way less than 1%? Yeah,
really?
Yeah, way less than 1%.
I tell you what, there's a couple of wines we use, and the failure rate is much higher than that. But they're particular producers, you know. There's a Grand Cru Centimillion we use that you got to take extra bottles just in case. And there's a Rioja as well that is real dodgy that we see a lot of failure rates as well. You've just got to taste them before you leave home, because you may need to take extra because of the cork rate. It's just unacceptable. So we talked about getting rid of the capsule to save a little bit of plastic. Not a lot. I think it was about a ton or half a ton for your wine range that you're getting rid of it. So it wasn't a big amount of plastic save. But the other big environmental thing is cans. How are they going?
They're going really well. They're going really well. Obviously, what we've done last year, we moved away from small bottles and 187 bottles and moved that into can, because again, we feel that cans more sustainable, infinite recyclable, certainly lighter, easier to produce in different environments.
And better packaging as well. I mean, and more condensed. You called it tessellation last week.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's about the production run as well, right? You buy a sheet of aluminium and you can make the can whatever size you want, and then you fill it. Whereas on bottles, you have to buy in those specific bottles, and it's the transportation of those bottles from point A to point B. And then, yeah, the bottles don't tessellate as well. You can't stack them. And they're much heavier. So, you know, it's more expensive, more carbon hungry to shift it all over the place. We've taken a lot off. Some of them you can't, so that because the DO, where it comes from, it can't be.
I noticed you use DO. That's Italian, isn't it? It's the bloody Italians. They are very funny about this.
Spain as well, Rioja.
Is it?
Yeah. So, and again, it'll be interesting to see. So, traditionally, they are not the fastest moving entities, but it'd be interesting to see if you have to move with the consumer, which we do. You know, do you stay in a 187 mil bottle because that's one of your rules, when the rest of the market has moved to what they believe is more sustainable, because you've just made a rule? Or do you change that rule and say, look, we need to change with the times? You know, interestingly, when you look at the spirits industry and look at RTDs, you know, they have taken the world by storm. And also, you can do more branding on a can. You get more brand stand out on shelf. You can make it more interesting, and you can talk about the product more. So, yeah, I think canned wine is certainly here to stay. I wonder if in 20, 30 years, people look back and say, God, I can't believe they're in 75 centilitre glass bottles for so long.
Yeah.
When they had, you know, 200, 250 mil cans just sitting there. And, you know, 500 mil, you know, is quite an interesting format. You know, the carafe in France is popular because two glasses of wine with a meal for two people works really, really well.
Yep.
And 75 centilitres is quite a lot, you know, it's quite a lot. And there's less wastage. So in terms of portion control, it's got a lot of benefits, and then certainly from sustainability. So yeah, they've been a roaring success. We're really, really happy with how that's going.
What's the big drawback? People used to talk about, because it's obviously a perfect seal cans, so you can land up into sulfur chemistry and mercaptans and all that sort of carry on. Is that sort of, and people talked about the acidity wearing the liners on the inside away and things like that. Is that thing all been solved, or is there certain wines that you just know you can't put into a can?
No, I think now with the production method of the aluminium, and also the efficacy of the machine and how you can get a fill rate much better. So there isn't this gap at the top. I think the way that those machines work and how they fill, so it's as much about the filling sometimes to make sure there's nothing else in there, which is why beer has always been so successful, because as you fill it and it froths over the top and then you cap it, the frothing beer has done your job for you because it's expelling as you put the cap on. But on wines, you don't have that luxury. So I think filling has got better, and I think the materials have got better.
And there's no concerns about acidity getting in and interacting with the aluminium?
So much less so now, and tests show that that's not an issue. The other thing is the length of time. So how long are you going to have that can sitting there? If you want to know whether it degrades after, you know, in between 6 to 8 years, we're not expecting people to buy a can and hold on to it and cellar it for 6 to 8 years. You know, it's basically immediate consumption. So because of the nature of the consumption and the speed with which you consume it, some of those fears go away because it just never arrives at that point.
Yeah, okay. And how's the consumer going with the cans?
They seem to love them. The sales are higher on cans than they were on 187ml bottles, which is interesting. So people seem to be really taking to them. I think it's just an easy format. I think people are used to it in RTD. They're used to it in beer. They're used to it in soft drinks. It's lighter. I think it's just easier. There's something which is easier about drinking from a can than drinking from a 187ml bottle as well. That feels like a bit of a weird experience.
I never drink a wine from a bottle. You miss half the wine.
Well, yeah, I mean...
Well, I have done it in the past, don't get me wrong, but there's times and needs.
Exactly. We've all been there. We've all been there. That's a different show and a different interview. I think... And you do lose a bit. It's true on a can. You do lose a bit if you drink from the can. It's not the same experience as pouring it out. But people seem to really, really like the format and carrying it around. It's lighter, it's easier. So yeah, and I think again the portion. I think we've got a few sizes out there ranging from 150 to 250. So I think it's that portion control element and deciding how much you're going to have, whether it's on a train on your way home or you're eating alone that night or there's two of you. So two 125 glasses in one 250ml can works perfectly. I think there are all sorts of benefits to the consumer, and I think that's what people are jumping on.
And also if you go to some events where glass is not allowed, obviously you've solved that problem.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And there's obviously the outdoor drinking, the ease of outdoor drinking and picnicking. It just makes more sense.
Okay then, Jamie, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.